So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 1, Text number 9. Okay, so this is a translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki. Okay, so, please therefore, okay, and the purport. In the Bhagavad Gita, worship of the Acharya is recommended. The Acharyas and the Goswamis are always absorbed in thought of the well-being of general public, especially the spiritual well-being. Spiritual well-being is automatically followed by material well-being. The Acharyas therefore give directions in spiritual well-being for all people in general. Foreseeing the incompetencies of the people in this age of Kali, or the iron age of quarrel, the sages requested that Suta Goswami give a summary of all revealed scriptures because the people of this age are condemned in every respect. The sages therefore inquire of the absolute good, which is the ultimate good for the people. The condemned state of affairs of the people of this age is described as follows. Om Ajnana Dirmandascha Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuru Militam Yena Tasmei Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swampadantikam Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Prachanine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pasatya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we'll read the translation one more time. Please, therefore, being blessed with many years, explain to us in an easily understandable way what you have ascertained to be the absolute and ultimate good for the people in general. Okay, Hare Krishna everyone. So of course I'd like to seek the blessings of all the devotees present today that I would be able to repeat what I've heard in the matter of this scripture that we're reading, Srimad Bhagavatam. So I actually chose this verse because this verse is like the beginning of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. It is a very fascinating verse because it's a question. So I thought maybe it'd be nice to give a little brief history up to the point that we're in at the moment of this verse. So of course we know that Srimad Bhagavatam was actually spoken 5,000 years ago. And what happened was 5,000 years ago, there is a sacred place in India called Naimisharanya. So it is here that all the sages, the saintly people, who were actually aspiring for self-realization, they gathered at this holy place. And they decided to do a sacrifice for 1,000 years. In those days, sacrifice was recommended because if you wanted to benefit society. So this is what they did. They gathered together. They went to this forest and they were performing sacrifice for satisfying Krishna, the Supreme Person of Godhead, and people in general. And this is what happens. One day, after their morning rituals, they got together and then they finished their meditation, they finished their prayers. And then ultimately what happened is then they offered an esteemed seat to their teacher. So every morning when a spiritual practitioner performs his meditation, then they have a discourse on spiritual wisdom. And this discourse helps them to how to practically apply the knowledge that is given in a practical way. So these 1,000 sages gave an esteemed seat to the teacher, and the teacher was Suta Goswami. And it is here that this whole discourse took place. So these sages were asking different questions to the teacher, Suta Goswami, And this is where the whole Srimad Bhagavatam begins. Sages first started glorifying the teacher. What is the qualification of Suta Goswami? Why is it that he has a qualification to actually speak? You know? And so when we read the first 8 verses, you'll see that what the sages are doing is they're glorifying the teacher, Suta Goswami, and at the same time they're listing his qualities. The first thing they say is that he's free from vice. He's completely selfless and he is very knowledgeable. He has a lot of wisdom which he has accumulated from his own teachers. And therefore the sage is saying, because you're well-versed, you know knowledge of every aspects of life, from metaphysics to spiritual knowledge to science. And it is therefore they're asking Suta Goswami the questions about life in general. So the sages actually ask Suta Goswami 6 questions. And this is the first question. The first question that the sages ask is, they're asking him, what is the absolute and ultimate good for people in general? Now, this is such an interesting question because it's mentioned that that spiritual practitioners, their main concern is the welfare of others. You know, their welfare comes secondary. Devotees are actually known as para dukkhi dukkhi, meaning that their happiness is seeing others happy, and their sadness or their misery is seeing other people miserable. I remember this marathon time. I was during the marathon time, we were doing books. It was in Liverpool, and it was nice because and actually I started thinking about this aspect of how saintly or spiritual people are para dukkhi dukkhi. And there you always see the fundraisers. You always see fundraisers come and they're also doing good work as well. And so I just started talking to one of them and she basically said, it's like people. I said, how are you finding the people here in Liverpool? And she goes, yeah, like they're very miserable, aren't they? And it's like, yeah, that's the reason why we're here. We're trying to help them out and, you know, teach them meditation. And she goes, yeah, when I look at these people, it makes my life happy. Like, I'm so grateful. You know, like, I'm glad I'm not miserable like these people. You know? So that was her consciousness. And I was just reflecting that she was happy because her life is okay and other people's life is miserable. You know? And this is interesting how the sage is actually asking questions and performing sacrifices. What is the ultimate benefit and good for people in general? And this is where the whole Srimad Bhagavatam begins. In essence, the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is actually teaching someone the journey of how to find real happiness. Real wealth for people is ultimately to be happy. So therefore the sages are asking these questions and Suta Goswami now elaborates on this whole concept of what is true happiness. Now we know happiness is such a big topic. A few weeks ago, we were in Cambridge, as part of Krishna Conscious Society, and one of the topics we had was, is happiness a choice? Do we choose to be happy, or is it something that we just naturally are? And there's so much research done about what is happiness, the philosophical aspect of it, can we really and truly be happy? And it's amazing, when I was doing some research, I actually found some very amazing thing that nowadays, researchers and psychologists actually have come up with a formula of how to be happy. And I'm serious, it's like a proper formula, you know, like an equation. And when I looked into this, it was very interesting, you know. So the good news is, actually, dear devotees, you don't need to read Srimad Bhagavatam, you don't need to read Bhagavad Gita, don't worry about chanting, just apply this formula and you'll be happy, according to psychology. Would you like to know the formula? You don't seem so happy to know the formula. Would you like to know the formula? Yeah, let's dissect this formula. Can I get someone to? Is that okay? Can we just flip the board, please? Yeah. So I thought it'd be nice to make it interactive. So I think you're doing some magic trick, but I don't think it was appropriate here. So the good news is I haven't come across one formula, but we have 2 formulas for happiness. And you know what? You can take your pick, whichever one you want. Okay? So we have there's equation one, and then we have equation two. And so you can take your pick, whichever one you want. And from the looks of it, it seems like everyone is very inclined to equation one. It seems like everyone are understanding what it's all about. This is no joke. I did not take this formula from my engineering books. This is actually a scientific research that they've done. And this is an equation that came up for happiness. This equation one was actually a research done by the University College of London by an esteemed professor. And they've done the research. They actually surveyed about 18,000 people. And because of that, they come up with this formula. Now, what does this formula mean? So without getting into the technicalities of it, I'll tell you the essence. And then the research basically concluded that if you want to be happy, you should have low expectations. Basically, that's what the conclusion of the research was. If you have low expectation and in life something happens beyond those expectations, naturally you will be happy. You know, so the example they did was of a gambling match. So they said, if you're going to win £2, but the other alternative was you're going to win £4, your happiness decreases. But if you win the same £2 and the other alternative was you won't win anything, then your happiness increases. And then they did a really interesting survey that, you know, in life we become disappointed. Why? And mostly it comes down to expectation. They say when we have this amount of expectation and then the reality is here, below the expectation, the gap between the expectation and reality is what we call disappointment. But when we have lower expectation and reality is above the expectation, the gap between that is called happiness. And that was basically the conclusion of this research. But it doesn't end there. They say this happiness fades away in due course of time. So really, this is just, they say this is how you get momentarily happiness. So, okay, maybe that's not how we can be happy, you know? Can we really have low expectations in life? Can a student comes up to his parents saying, you know, mom, I'm going to get low grade, so if I get higher, I'll be happy. Doesn't quite work like that, does it? So that was the shortcoming or shortfall of that equation. The second equation I came across was equation number two. And this is different social studies that was done, and they showed that actually happiness means... basically, the social study says that if people are happy, they can perform very well at their workplace. Okay? If you have employees that are happy, they will actually increase your productivity. And this is a formula they came up with. In order for people to be happy, it is resources divided by desire. In essence, if you want to be happy, have more resources. Okay? Happiness and resources are proportionate. Or the other alternative is happiness is inversely proportionate to desire. Meaning if you want to be more happy, reduce your desire. Basically, that's the essence. Now, does it really make sense? Right? So then they actually wrote this report and they dissected this concept. Now, it's saying happiness, there's two problems with this. If you want to increase your happiness, you have to increase your resources. Now, first of all, we have limited resources in the world. So really, you can't increase resources that much. It's all limited, right? And even if you increase your resources, it means that if you're increasing your resources, you're taking away the resources from someone else. So in essence, your happiness is basically at the cost of someone else being miserable. An example is given like, a doctor will make his money when patients are sick, you know? And therefore, that's what this formula is implying. So that maybe doesn't work. We can't increase our resources because resources are limited. So the other possibility to increase our happiness is to reduce our desire. Now, can we really reduce our desires? No. Desires are probably more than what the resources are. You know, and sometimes people say, well, reducing a desire, you're suppressing your desire. Reducing desire means you're becoming less ambitious. You know? So the formula, there is something wrong with this formula also. So then this is where I started researching more into the concept of happiness. And then I came across an article that said that if we look for happiness from a material perspective, there will be limitation because that's the nature of material existence. And then ancient wisdom explained that our existence is of two dimensions. You have the material dimension, and there's a spiritual dimension. And in order for us to be completely happy, you have to consider the spiritual dimension also. And this is the reason why the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is spoken. The sages at this forest are 6 questions. These 6 questions are then expanded into 18,000 verses, and it teaches you the science of happiness. Now, someone would argue that, my God, 18,000 verses. I don't have time to go through all that. Right? Isn't it? So therefore, the sages are very smart. Krishna, the Supreme Lord, is very smart. He knows that in the age that we're living in now, time is very crucial. So what he does is he gives you a version of GCSE bite size. Does everyone know what GCSE bite size is? I remember when I was studying my GCSE and you got like a whole syllabus, but you can know the whole syllabus in a week. It's called GCSE bite size. So we also have a spiritual wisdom bite size. It's called the Bhagavad Gita. So we all know what the Bhagavad Gita is. Bhagavad Gita is like spiritual wisdom bite size. The 18,000 verses has been nicely summarized and is given in an essence format in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is a very, very practical and very universal book. The principles it teaches can really help one become successful, not only materially, but also find spiritual success as well. And, you know, just to give you the gist, and today that's what I wanted to do, was just to dissect the concept of Bhagavad Gita. So we know Bhagavad Gita is a wisdom, is a book that was, believe it or not, a conversation that was spoken in the middle of a battlefield. There was a war about to happen between two sides. We could say the goody and the baddie, and the war's about to happen. And what happens is a conversation takes place. In the goody side, there is a very powerful warrior. His name is Arjuna. Arjuna, he's a powerful warrior. He's an archer. And he is really, really powerful. But just before the battle's about to commence, he has midlife crisis, you could say. Right, he has a fear, he goes to depression, he's stressed out. And at that point, he actually asks his teacher, who's actually a chariot driver, or Krishna, his best friend. And he tells Krishna, take me in the middle of the battlefield, and I want to see who's here to fight. And this is where Krishna then takes the chariot in the middle of the battlefield, and it is here where they have, believe it or not, about 45-minute conversation. Now, I don't know who was there with a stopwatch measuring the conversation time, but this is what I've heard. So it's a 45-minute conversation. In this conversation, Arjuna is asking deeper questions about life, and he's exploring this whole concept of happiness. And Krishna, in the beginning, when Arjuna's talking about his problem, Krishna's just simply smiling. He's smiling because he's saying now he's come to the point in his life where he's ready to understand spiritual knowledge. So Krishna basically says to Arjuna that actually, Arjuna, if you want to be happy, you have to have the understanding of 5 simple topics. If you understand these 5 topics, you will understand what is real happiness. And this is why Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, to elaborate on these 5 simple topics about life. And this is what I wanted to do. I want to actually just explore this concept on these 5 topics and see maybe if we can understand what happiness is, you know. And the amazing thing about Krishna when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita is that he makes kind of a disclaimer. He wants readers of the Bhagavad Gita not to accept anything blindly. He specifically says that, and that's why you'll see ancient wisdom like the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita is like a conversation, it's a question answer. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, you'll see Krishna will make certain statements and Arjuna will argue back, saying, oh Krishna, this doesn't make sense. Can you please explain more? So Krishna is also emphasizing on the idea that don't accept anything blindly. Use your intelligence and dissect the concept so your understanding increases. So the first topic Krishna says to Arjuna, and this is the first lesson the spiritual wisdom from the East explain, is that before you go on a journey to find happiness, it is very important to find out who you are. Now, generally, when we ask who we are, it's such a simple question. But when you actually dissect this again, you'll realize that it's not as simple as it sounds. You know, many times when we say to people who you are, people will come up with different ideas because we have different layers of identity. People will say their name. They'll identify themselves with their age, their background, their likes, their dislikes, gender, their hobbies, their profession also. And these are the different layers of identity we have. But Krishna explains that your real identity is the essence of you that never changes. Okay? So for example, right now, you know, I have a particular body, but 10 years ago, I would probably look different, but I'm still the same person. I'm still Janaki Nath. And therefore, Krishna's explaining that you're none of these secondary, superficial thing, because these things change. Your name can change. Your age can change. Every moment your age is changing. Even gender, nowadays technology, we've made so much advancement that gender can change also. So gender cannot be your identity also. So in essence, Krishna's saying that actually, Arjuna, if you really want to know who you are, and this is where he's talking about the concept, he goes, actually, you are not this material body, you are the spirit soul. That's the first lesson Krishna's saying. Once you understand that you're not this body, you're the soul, then your direction in where you find happiness changes. Krishna's saying that as a spirit soul, your happiness does not come from the external. It's not that things will make you happy, because happiness is something that you have within you, but right now it is covered. So what Krishna does is he very systematically explains the nature of the soul. Krishna first thing says is, okay, so how do you know the soul exists? So Krishna explains that actually the symptoms of the soul is consciousness. Okay? And Krishna's very, very interestingly saying that lower the consciousness, you're more susceptible to the miseries of this life. However, if you expand and raise your consciousness, you will be able to tap into higher dimensions of spiritual existence where you can experience real happiness. You know? And Krishna gives many amazing examples. People think that this body will give us pleasure. So he's explaining that we're looking for the right thing, but we're looking for it in the wrong place. This body is a vehicle. It's a vehicle which we use to actually go towards a spiritual journey. But happiness does not come from this body. And Krishna is saying that it's our inherent nature to be and experience pleasure. Pleasure is not a bad thing. That is what we're really looking for, pleasure. But the problem arises is when you look for pleasure within this body, this is where you will be disappointed, because this body is limited. And when you analyze, actually, this body, actually, it gives us more misery than happiness. And this is something I can relate to because I've gone through it. I want everyone to meditate on their toe. No, I'm serious. Please meditate on your toe. Okay, now I want you guys to tell me, how much pleasure is your toe giving you right now? None. None. Going through saying none. How many of you have woken up in the morning and said, I'm so happy because my toe is giving me so much pleasure? Very rare, right? But now imagine if someone drops a rock on your toe, right? What's your experience here? You're in pain. The experience of pain is far greater than the experience of happiness. And this is the nature of the body. The happiness that we are hungry for cannot be satisfied by bodily demands. Even when you look at hunger, we think hunger is a good thing because we can eat and we can be happy. But hunger is actually a form of misery. When you don't get food, we're miserable. So it's mentioned actually, happiness from a bodily platform is just the absence of misery. You know? So Krishna's saying it's good you're looking for happiness, it's good you're looking for pleasure, but look for it in the right place, which is not from the body, but it comes from the soul. And therefore, Krishna systematically explains the nature of the soul is actually, it's full of knowledge, it is blissful, it's experiencing happiness all the time, and it's eternal. Jai Shishi Radha Gokul Nanda Ki, Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki, Gornitai Ki. Jai. So this is the first principle Krishna explains, that you're not this body, you are actually the spirit soul. And real happiness will actually, you'll experience when you tap into your true eternal self. And this does not depend on anything external. So when you actually tap into your soul, nothing external can affect your happiness. which means anything material, anything materially bad will happen to you, you're not phased out by it. You can still stay focused in life. So this is the first thing Krishna explains to Arjuna. What is your true identity? Your identity is you're the spirit soul, and real happiness will come from your spiritual nature and not this material or the matter of this existence. Krishna then explains the second topic of the Bhagavad Gita. And the second topic of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains the nature of the world we're living in. Now, many times when we do different talks and we speak to people in general, a lot of times people say, if God actually exists, then why did he create a world where there's so much suffering? Therefore, I conclude that God doesn't exist because there's so much suffering in this world. Why would God, who's all-loving, create a world where there's so much suffering? And it is a very interesting question, isn't it? You know? And when I was trying to find out answers, I was asking my mentors about this question. It was interesting because my mentor told me that when you look at this question, if God exists, why is there so much suffering in this world? There is a huge assumption made here. What's that assumption? The assumption is that this world is made to find happiness. Right? That's the assumption. But who said that this world is made for us to find happiness? It's mentioned that actually the whole purpose of this material world is actually to make us realize that we don't belong of this dimension. Material world is an unnatural situation for us. Recently I came across a survey also done, and they were doing a survey on what do people do to relax. When people are stressed out, they want to relax. What are the different ways people do to relax? People, devotees can throw out. London. Go to the movies. Excellent. Alcohol. Yeah. People indulge in intoxication. Anything else? Sleep. Sleep is another one. When people are just tired, they want to just take time out, they will knock out. Take rest. What else? Sauna and jacuzzi. Go for some health treatment, health spa. Right? And then, yes, Shaturu. TV, big thing, right? People watch TV, it helps them relax. And sometimes it may do. And in this survey, it actually concluded that out of all the things that people do to relax, you know what the top three answers was? The first one was, of course, sleep. Sleep was the first thing people do to relax. Second thing was entertainment. You know, absorbing yourself, either playing some PlayStation, PS2. Oh, no, wait, there's PS4 out now, right? Yeah, so there's PS4. And then there is watching movies, etc. That's the second thing, entertainment. And the third thing is intoxication, whether it is drugs, alcohol, etc. These are the top three ways people actually engage them in when they want to relax. Now, when you analyze these three activities, you'll see that these three activities, people engaging because they want to escape reality. Isn't it? When engaging these three activities, you're trying to escape reality. So in this article was mentioned that actually it is very natural for our tendency to escape this material reality. Why? Because we don't belong of the material dimension. We're actually made for a whole new dimension called the spiritual existence. So Krishna basically designed the material world in such a way that it teaches us to how to live in this world but not be affected by it. You know? And it's mentioned that in this world, we are exposed by many different influences. And these influences covered by the three modes. They're different energies that all living entities get influenced by. And there are certain influences that when we get exposed to, we tap into our lower self. But there are certain influences which if we tap into, we'll actually tap into our higher self. So Krishna explains the nature of this material world, and he explains what are the influences that will help us tap into our lower self? What are the influences that help us tap into our higher self? And he systematically explains that. And there's this famous statement, I forgot the philosopher's name, but the philosopher says that we are not human beings having a spiritual existence, rather we are spiritual beings having a human experience. Sorry. You know? And that's the second topic that Krishna explains. The third topic that Krishna also explains is a big topic. Everyone talks about it, but a lot of times people actually don't know much about it. Even in movies, that this concept is explored, and there are songs as well. You know, one of my songs that I used to like on this topic was sang by Justin Timberlake, and he actually sang a song. I'm not going to sing it because I don't want to spoil the song for those who like this song. But one of the lyrics of this song was, "What goes around, comes around, come back around again." You know, that's the essence. And the topic he was referring to was karma, and that's the third topic Krishna talks about in the Bhagavad Gita, the concept of karma. What does karma actually mean? You know, everyone thinks karma means every action has a reaction. But when you actually think about this, does that actually make sense? Does every action has a reaction? If so, then why did good things happen to bad people and vice versa? And Krishna actually explains that karma is very, very intricate to understand. But the general principles, we can understand. And when you understand the general principles, every mysteries in life, actually, you'll be able to understand. And in essence, Krishna is saying that if you understand the science of karma, one has the ability to design their own destiny, which is very powerful, you know. And this is what Krishna is talking about, karma. Understand how karma works, you know, and he gives the whole science behind karma. The fourth topic that Krishna is explaining also, who explains that if you understand this concept or this topic, you'll be able to understand what happiness is. It's interesting. I just came up with this analogy this morning. Bhagavad Gita is a book that teaches you how to make good investment of your wealth. Yeah? We all have wealth. If you want to invest your wealth to get good return, read the Bhagavad Gita. Now, I'm not saying that Bhagavad Gita is going to teach you how to invest your money in stock market. That's not what I'm saying. Because every time we say wealth, the general concept, the general thing that people refer to wealth is money. But that's not what Krishna's saying. He's saying, what is the true wealth of a living entity? What do you think our true wealth is? This topic that Krishna talks about, saying this is our true wealth. This wealth is more valuable than money. Because money you can lose, but you can get it back. But this wealth he's talking about, you lose it, and not even a single moment you'll get back. So what are we talking about? Time. Krishna's talking about time. And Krishna's saying that time is very, very valuable in our life. And he's saying that if you invest your time on material things, on the material body, it is an investment where you're not going to get a single percent return. Because anything invested in the body, at the end, we're going to lose it. So Krishna is saying, do not invest your time in the wrong thing. Invest in the right thing. So he explains that actually, time is very valuable. And by reading the Bhagavad Gita, it's not going to give you more than 24 hours. That's one thing I want to clarify. A lot of times people think, if I read the Bhagavad Gita, I will get more hours in my day. No. Everyone will still have 24 hours. But one thing Bhagavad Gita will teach you to do is it will help you become time conscious. It will help you to understand how to effectively use your time so you become more proactive and you can prioritize things in your life. And that's what Bhagavad Gita will help you do. So when you prioritize your life, when you prioritize what the needs are, you'll see actually you will buy more time in life. And that's the fourth topic, you know. And you know, there's one thing, these four topics, it kind of makes sense, but there's one thing that will glue, one, the last topic will glue all of these four concepts together. Now, as I mentioned, today's verse was about the sages asking their teacher, Suta Goswami, that what is the ultimate welfare of human beings, people in general. And Suta Goswami, in essence, says the real wealth for people is developing loving relationship with God. That is what the ultimate welfare benefit of people will be. That when people develop loving relation with God, automatically their needs are fulfilled, and at the same time, they can also give this love to people in society. And so the fifth topic that the Bhagavad Gita actually talks about is this aspect of God. It's a question that a lot of great thinkers and philosophers have debated about his existence, whether God exists, does he not exist. And Krishna now gives wisdom on this whole aspect of who God is, what is his nature, you know. And if God exists, then why is there so much suffering in this world? And so the idea is that there is suffering in this world because people are disconnected with God. That's the true essence, you know. Like Many times people say, if everything comes from God, then does evil come from God also? And that question is quite interesting, because it's like saying that, does darkness exist? Darkness doesn't exist. Darkness is the absence of light. So similarly, when you take God out of the picture, the consequences is like the shadow of God, or evil, basically. You know, so and the essence is that the nature of a living being is that the need is a onefold: to give love and to be loved. And that is what it is. When this love is satisfied, real happiness will naturally come about. This Tuesday we had a talk at Cambridge University, and we came up with an interesting title. It was called "There Is No Such Thing as Love, Happy Valentine's Day." That was a topic that we came up with. And of course, there is no truth to that statement. It was just a catchy title to attract people to come. And it was fantastic. We had like really amazing discussion with the students. Cambridge students are very analytical, you know, and they're really, the way they think is amazing, because they look at different angles. And it was nice because we got to dissect this concept of love from different angles. And in that session, we basically concluded that, you know, we're all looking for love. But ancient wisdom explained that the love that can really satisfy an individual is something called unconditional love. But in this world, there is no such thing as unconditional love, because the closest unconditional love you'll get is between a mother and a child. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is actually explaining that the only way one gets unconditional love is when one is connected to the source who has unconditional love. That's God. So the reason why we can't give unconditional love is because we don't have it ourselves, right? But when you're connected with God, who's a reservoir of all good qualities, including pure love, then you have access to pure love, your desire satisfied, and because your desire satisfied, you're nourished, you can freely give pure love to every single person in this world without expecting anything in return. You know, and that's what the sages goes. In order for people to be happy and successful, they have to connect with God. Because when they connect with God, they will understand their true nature, which is the spirit soul. They will understand what is their duty in this material world. And they can actually have a nice, balanced and healthy lifestyle. Many times people have this misconception that if we try to go on a spiritual journey, it will impede my material success. This is the biggest misconception one can have. Material success, spiritual success can go hand in hand. When you're naturally happy, your productivity, your ambition in material success also increases, you know, because you're naturally happy, you're nourished. And therefore, if you want material success, having spiritual element and strong spiritual foundation will help you do that, because it will help you deal with different challenges. When you have failures, which is going to happen, it's foolish to think that, you know, you can't fail. Failing, in fact, is a very good thing, because they say failure is like a stepping stone to success. But you have to have the right consciousness to actually be able to deal with these. And that's why Krishna's explaining that if you understand these five topics, then you'll understand what happiness is and how you can actually achieve real happiness. So it's like 3 minutes left for the class to be over, but I wanted to open up for comments and questions.